give fluid cautiously, and keep reassessing the child.
As part of your assessment and your actions in the first hour, I want you to consider using vasoactive drugs.
But I think there's this real fear of giving inotropes without an intensivist by your side.
So you need to think ahead. You need to, whilst you're giving fluids, you need to be thinking about inotropes. Whilst you're preparing the inotropes, you need to be thinking about anaesthetic input.
This is the second part of our management of sepsis. So our second guest is also south of the river, but a bit further south. Can I introduce Professor Mark Peters, who's a consultant paediatric intensivist, who is ringing in today from Great Ormond Street Hospital, London. Hi, Mark.
We
had the great pleasure of having a phone call just now from somebody called Mark, and I started talking to them all about sepsis, and he tried to sell me a mobile phone.
Did you buy?
No, I was waiting for something better.
Okay, good.
And I wanted to get you and Sachin and me together because I was hoping some of your good advice and common sense and knowledge would rub off on the rest of us. And I also had a question. Why is your Twitter handle pus27?
I can't remember. That's a long time ago. It just is.
All right. So I'm hoping that you can digest all the current evidence and help us unpick what is the best management in paediatric sepsis. And I think we're going to move on and talk about fluids. I think this is something that the junior doctors really worry about which fluid to choose and why and how much. So what advice have you got for them?
Okay, so... And this is the question that worries everybody the most. And when we were in training, we didn't see a complexity about this, in that there was a clear view that 20 mils per kilo of anything you had to hand that was isotonic was reasonable to give. And the guidance in the last 15 years or so has been predominantly aliquots of 20 mils per kilo as quickly as you can, up to and over 60 mils per kilo in the first hour. And that all related to Joe Carcillo from the US's work that suggested that children who were resuscitated with higher volumes of fluid had case mix adjusted outcomes better than those who were resuscitated with lower volumes of fluid. And that actually seemed to match what happens clinically. If you give fluid aggressively, you see, in most cases, you see the heart rate come down, you see pulse pressure changes, and you see improved perfusion. So there's this really appealing acute physiological response that encourages us to give fluid.
Mark, what you say is really interesting. I think it's absolutely true that we always just, as a knee-jerk response, pick up 20 mils per kilo of isotonic fluid and give it. And the evidence behind that is actually quite old. Tell us what's changed recently and why.
Okay, so I think in recent years, and this is partly pediatric data and partly adult data, there is an understanding that a positive balance on the ICU is associated with poor outcome. And picking apart how much of that is related to how sick you are and therefore how easily your vascular system leaks and therefore how much fluid you're given is very difficult.
I think that's really important because, like, if we're looking at Sachin and you're sitting in a district general hospital and you can only measure blood pressure through a cuff and you haven't got any invasive monitoring, it's really hard to judge how much fluid is too much.
I couldn't agree more. I think it's one of the hardest judgments in resuscitation.
What would you say about that, Sachin?
Hi, Mark. I've just learned something and just goes on to say that practices do take long to change, but that is one of the challenges. I was involved with managing a child in a septic shock. And after 40 mils per kilo, we had the anesthetist and we did what we were as part of the algorithm. But I started to hear crackles in the chest. And I had to put my brakes on. But where you're coming from is from the ICU end, and definitely from a DGH perspective, as jobbing pediatricians, I could relate to exactly what you're saying, that indiscriminate overzealous giving may be helpful, but actually when you guys pick these children up on the ICU end, there may be a bit of a issue with what we do on the shop floor.
Yes, I mean, I think the feeling has been better to over-treat than to under-treat, and getting the balance is difficult because the ICU can, you know, by the use of positive pressure ventilation and, if necessary, renal replacement therapy, can cope with fluid overload. But understanding that that brings all sorts of other complications is important. So what the guidance has evolved over the last 15 or 20 years or so is now much more considered about looking for signs of hypervolemia. So as soon as you hear crackles in the chest or as soon as you feel a liver edge, you should just pause with the fluid resuscitation and reconsider. And we didn't used to include that 10 or 15 years ago.
So I think that's a really important point. The first thing is, I'd say really simple things like get good measurements, because so often blood pressures, people choose the wrong size cuff. So if you have the wrong size cuff, you're not getting an accurate blood pressure. Second of all, every time you give a bolus of fluid, stop, reassess the patient before you give more.
Yes, I think we can be quite confident with that. We were part of the group with David Inwold that recently completed a trial looking at using 10 mils per kilo per fluid bolus compared to 20 mils per kilo per fluid bolus. And the arms are equivalent. But both arms required that the resuscitators reassess the patient after each bolus. So actually, it's probably the give and check that's more important than the volume you administer.
And that's much more in line with the trauma guidelines. I think people felt good about doing things, so they gave fluid because it made you feel better because you were actually doing something. But there's quite a lot of evidence, as you rightly said, that too much fluid is bad for you. So can you tell me where this evidence has come from?
Well, the most important and the study in this area is the FEAST study from Cath Maitland in East Africa. And the FEAST study is a fantastic piece of work in over 3,000 children acutely unwell with infection who were randomized to one of three groups, which was either no volume resuscitation with albumin, or volume resuscitation with normal saline. And the really disruptive result this produced was that the saline albumin groups were equivalent, but both had a higher mortality than the no fluid resuscitation group. And then the question ever since has been, what does that mean for a high resource setting with availability to intensive care? And I think without there being an equivalent study in our setting, you cannot be confident. But there are a few reasons to doubt the generalizability of that result into our population.
So if we think about it, in the FEAST study, they were a very different group of children to the children that we see every day. So these children were severely anemic and they had high rates of malaria. And they were coming in with largely bacterial infections compared to the population we see.
That's true. And the control group mortality was, I think, around 7.5%, which is lower than we would be seeing in the severe shock population referred to intensive care in the UK. So, and what that means is that if you're in a relatively low mortality population, you've got to justify every intervention you do more carefully, because it has, every intervention has the potential to do harm. And I think the other consideration is the mechanisms for harm of excessive fluid are several-fold. They include cardiovascular, respiratory, and neurological. But each of those can be mitigated by good quality intensive care. So I think I'll be very cautious about inferring too much from the FEAST study, though I think it's a really important warning message for us to, that fluid does have a downside. Translating that into practice where we have positive pressure ventilation, ready access to cardiovascular assessment and invasive, and the ability to tightly control and monitor CO2 and blood pressure to mitigate neurological injury, that's just not equivalent to the East African population. So it's a warning sign, but I don't think it should form the basis of our recommendation.
And can you explain to people why is it that not giving fluid might have helped those children?
I don't think we can say for certain, but it's possible that those children were had undergone a selection by being the children who survived to arrive in hospital. And it may well be that their volume cardiac output relationship was on the Starling curve. They were already near the top of their Starling curve. So extra fluid may well have deteriorated their cardiovascular function.
Why is it in the FEAST trial that giving fluid harmed children?
I don't think we know for certain why giving fluid harmed those children. It may be that we had the downsides of fluids, of increased interstitial fluid without the upside of improving cardiac output. And there's some observational data that suggests that's the case.
And so have you got any evidence about giving fluid boluses in our situation in the UK?
The Paediatric Intensive Care Society study group and the Perucci, which is the Emergency Medicine Group, conducted a study called the FISH study, the Fluids in Shock study that David Imwald from Imperial led. And that compared the outcomes for children resuscitated with aliquots of 10 mils per kilo versus those of 20 mils per kilo. And both arms of the study included a requirement to assess for signs of ongoing shock, but also for signs of fluid overload. And interestingly, the two groups were equivalent, although it was only a pilot study, so you can't infer that definitively. But encouragingly, the mortality in the study overall was zero. So fluid resuscitation with careful attention to signs of fluid overload and signs of shock resolution can be very good, whether you're using 10 mils per kilo or 20 mils per kilo.
Perfect. So what you're saying, what your take-home message is, give fluid cautiously, and keep reassessing the child.
Absolutely. Reassessment and a feedback loop and understanding what you're looking for. So, and the two things you're looking for is, are there residual signs of shock or perfusion or abnormal organ function? But also, are there signs of fluid overload? And that might be crackles throughout the chest. It might be hepatomegaly. It might be that the heart rate doesn't fall when you give fluid. All of those signs should give you reason to pause and consider other strategies.
Perfect. Sachin, when you're out there in the real world trying to do this in the middle of the night with the junior doctor who's never done pediatrics before, tell us how that translates into real practice.
Yeah, I think the biggest resource we have now is sort of a bank of senior nurses who are experienced. I do rely a lot on institutional memory or our senior nursing staff who actually on the ground, in the absence of a consultant coming in, they are able to guide and sometimes hold our middle grades' hands and take them through what they have seen and done in the past. And having these simulation when we run them, it makes a massive, we've seen a massive difference in the confidence and competencies in the last 5 years that we've been running when we've changed the pathway. But coming back to something relevant to what Mark was saying earlier on about fluid resuscitation, giving smaller aliquots, I think there is something that we do with neonates who are shocked or and we give them 10 mils per kilo fluid boluses. And I think that is something which may make it easier to use across the board. We feel comfortable giving 10 per kilo.
And while we're just one last thing on fluids, we haven't really talked about fluid choices. And I'm showing my age here because when I was a junior doctor, we used human albumin all the time. So we used to give every child HAS. And now people automatically pick up normal saline. And my feeling is that once they've got to 40 mils per kilo, people just tend to carry on. Would you have anything to say about that, Mark?
So I'm a similar age to you and also grew up on human albumin. And there's a few things to be said for it. It does have a slightly high chloride load, so you will get an acidosis after large volumes. And most of the time, our advice is that the delay inherent in most healthcare settings in obtaining albumin means it's not worth the hassle. The honest answer is, for children, there's no evidence to prefer one fluid over another. There are some physiological bases for preferring fluids that don't have quite such a high chloride content. But in practice, it's probably more important that you get on and give some fluid quickly, as long as it's not hypotonic, than worrying too much about which fluid.
Perfect. I like a simple answer. So give something quickly, isotonic fluid. So examples of that would be normal saline.
If you're interested in a career in paediatrics, the best specialty in medicine, please see www.rcpch.ac.uk/careers. This podcast was brought to you by Medisense Medical Education. Learn medicine differently through podcasts, games, videos, role plays and more at www.medisense.org.uk.
So often, sepsis is uncomplicated, that children get a bit of fluid and some antibiotics, and that might be enough. That's what you see every couple of weeks. But there are these children who go into septic shock, and I think that that is when fluid is just not enough. How often would you see that, Sachin, and what are the problems with treating these kind of children in a district general hospital?
So children who come in who need more than fluids, the numbers are going to be smaller and it's less frequent. So I'm not sure whether I'm the only DGH pediatrician, but I can remember sort of using adrenaline and dopamine in handful of situations in the past 10 years. Maybe we haven't used inotropes more effectively in the past, and that might be changing.
Excellent. And I think there's absolutely a barrier because sepsis is rare and these very sick children don't come around all that often. What are your important messages to all these paediatricians out there, Mark, when fluid is just not enough?
So the message I would encourage our colleagues in the district general hospitals is the one that's included in the sepsis 6, that as part of your assessment and your actions in the first hour, I want you to consider using vasoactive drugs. And we spoke before about how fluid resuscitation, we're less confident of it being always beneficial than we were perhaps a few years ago. And so I think if we're less confident about fluid resuscitation, one of the consequences is that we probably have to lower our threshold for starting vasoactive drugs. And the key in any shock resuscitation is anticipating what you're going to do if your current treatment isn't effective. And so I think even at the point at which you're giving the first fluid bolus, you should be considering, have you got sufficient access and what your drug choice is going to be for vasoactive drugs.
I think that's so important. I absolutely agree with you. There's one message, which is use inotropes early. And I think people, so my experience of this is everybody is really scared of inotropes. And last week, one of my juniors came up to me and they said, oh, Emma, you'll be really proud of me. We've had this child, they were septic, we did everything. We even gave inotropes. And I was like, that's amazing. I'm really impressed. And they said, well, we drew up the inotropes, we had the infusion there, but we were too scared to actually attach it to the cannula until PICU came down. And I said, well, that's not giving inotropes because the child didn't get them. It's no use them just sitting in the syringe. But I think there's this real fear of giving inotropes without an intensivist by your side.
One of the things that's changing in the last few years is that we now give a clear recommendation that the first choice inotrope should be adrenaline or epinephrine, if you prefer. And a potential downside of that is that sounds like quite a serious drug compared to dopamine, which people have often used as first line. But there's good evidence to recommend adrenaline as first line now.
Absolutely. I've seen that time and time again, that people feel happy using dopamine. They used it before, they used it in neonates, but actually the message now is you've got one choice, you start adrenaline. And one of the worries is what you said about getting central lines in, because you can't get central line access.
So this is a really important issue, is what is appropriate access for resuscitation from septic shock. And the simple message is you do not need a central line. That's a luxury, and it makes things easier, but it's not a necessity. You can give adrenaline with very low risk of complications through a peripheral line. You can give adrenaline through an intraosseous needle. And there are large data sets that document you have very low complication rates of peripherally administered adrenaline or intraosseous administered adrenaline or even noradrenaline. So that really shouldn't be a block.
Now, we use a 10 times more dilute adrenaline solution, but the evidence is that for adrenaline peripherally that you're using for less than 4 hours, it's very unlikely to get extravasation problems, because that's the one thing people worry about. And if you are worried, just choose the intraosseous route. Have you had that problem, Sachin?
Probably not, because we've not used it enough.
I think one of the barriers to giving adrenaline, apart from fear, is making up the infusions and having a formula ready, because we don't do it that often.
Yes, I think that's right. And the way we handle that in my region is that we encourage our local hospitals to make contact with the transport service. That's CATS for us. And we can talk you through pairing the infusion, or it could be cross-referenced on the website.
So up north we have Nectar, and they have the formula for that. And we also have the formula for making up peripheral adrenaline on the back of our sepsis protocol, along with PICU's number.
Great.
These are two small things, but I think important. Dead space, titrating inotropes, dead space.
Peripheral cannula with an extension piece or an intraosseous needle with a connector has a significant dead space. The way I would recommend handling that is start the infusion at a rate significantly higher than you expect you're going to need as the original dose. So if it's adrenaline, your starting dose might be 0.05 micrograms per kilogram per minute or 0.1 micrograms per kilogram per minute, but you might start the infusion at, say, 0.25 or 0.3, until you start to see the first hint of a hemodynamic response, and then you can dial back to the maintenance dose, just so that you get through that dead space in the system a little more quickly.
So that's really straightforward, and I like that. So you're saying start at a higher dose than you expect to need, probably 0.3 mils per kilo per minute, and then once you see things improve, so your heart rate come down, your blood pressure come up, dial it back.
Yeah, so one of the things that should reassure operators using these drugs is they have fantastically short half-lives. So you can see the clinical effect of a dose change really very rapidly, up or down. And so I think that makes them relatively easy to use. It's no problem. If you start at too high a dose, you can very quickly reduce.
I think that's really good advice.
A really important element of this is to make sure that we're also, at the same time, supporting the airway and the breathing. And what I would encourage resuscitators to do is to involve senior anaesthetic support very early when it becomes clear that you're in a septic shock situation. And that's for two reasons. One, that to do a safe intubation in this sort of scenario takes preparation. It takes identifying the equipment and the right size tubes, etc. But it is also safer to induce anaesthesia and institute artificial respiration if you do it before it's absolutely necessary and your the child's respiratory function is failing. So senior anaesthetic involvement with time for them to consider, which may not, you know, preparation of induction agents that may not be there every day. Practice, we would recommend using ketamine, for example, so that this can be done as a semi-elective procedure rather than as a full-blown emergency resuscitation procedure.
Mark, what are your take-home messages with children in septic shock? What are the three things that you want people to do before they come to you?
So the take-home messages for resuscitation of a child in septic shock is that most of the reversible mortality is in the first few hours after presentation. And so your resuscitation needs to anticipate what you do if the child doesn't respond to your current treatment. So you need to think ahead. You need to, whilst you're giving fluids, you need to be thinking about inotropes. Whilst you're preparing the inotropes, you need to be thinking about anaesthetic input. The second point is you should have the most experienced staff available, whether that's pediatrics, accident emergency, nursing staff, anaesthesia. These are rare events, and expert resuscitation is difficult, and you need the most experienced staff available. And the final point is, in resuscitation, you can always back off. You can always turn the adrenaline down or stop it. You can always extubate the child who's done very well. But if you don't catch up in that first bit of resuscitation, it can get progressively harder to do so.
Love that. So you've got a golden hour, do too much, because you can always back down. Sachin.
Coming from a secondary care perspective, I would say these are one of those infrequent scenarios that we couldn't practice enough. So practice with regards to SIM training. Second, having been in some of the finest rhesus scenarios I've been in, I can't emphasize what Mark's just said about having a multi-professional team, which involves anesthetists, ED guys, and the pediatric lot. We bring in our own skills and our own awareness to the situation. So first is practice, second is multi-professional input, and third is something which I've just learned, and I'm going to say that don't be afraid to use adrenaline peripherally.
The other thing I think that's come across really strongly from what you say, Mark, is that actually The first hour is a golden hour, and what you do then is what makes the difference.
There's no doubt that the biggest potential income on outcome from septic shock is in the hands of the emergency room and the district general hospital staff.
The Paediatric Sepsis podcast series was brought to you by the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health and Medisense, with support from Health Education England.